The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to this recording of the American College of Osteopathic Internists Internal Medicine Board Review Course. The course was held in Baltimore at the Marriott Waterfront Hotel on May 8th through 12th, 2019. The course featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of importance to the internist preparing for initial certification or for recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Drug cause side effects and disorders is presented by Dr. Lloyd Cleaver.
So there was a question about cutaneous mets, and I wanted to address that. Cutaneous mets to the skin are usually locally from where the tumor is. And so, but it can be far distant. I've taken off a prostate from the scalp, and just a week and a half ago, I had a guy came in with a chest rash of 3 weeks duration. We biopsied it, thinking it was an inflammatory breast cancer, and did a scan. We did chest, abdomen, and pelvis, and he had a thyroid, which was the biggest that our radiologist had ever seen. It moved his esophagus and trachea to one side. That was biopsied. It was benign. He had two lesions on his liver, had a lesion in the dome of his bladder, and a huge prostate. And so the cancer turns out to be a bladder cancer metastatic to his liver and his chest wall. So you never know. And so we're going to go ahead and go through drug eruptions. Drug eruptions, of course, are one of those things that we love, but everybody gets frustrated with those, and we have a secret. I have no disclosures on this talk either. So when we look at a patient and we think it's a drug eruption, we have to rule out other cutaneous disease. And so then we look at the type of drug eruption, the morphology, and then we look at the statistics of the drugs that cause that. So it's really a statistical analysis of that, and then timing when that drug started. But that doesn't always completely limit the drug reactions. So the drug eruptions are extremely common. We see that all the time. They tend to be generalized and symmetric, often maculopapular or mobiliform. The best intervention, of course, is to stop the drug. And if you reduce the dose, it's not going to take care of it. You've got to stop the drug. And you all put patients on many drugs that they need. And so that becomes a problem in sorting those out and trying to get those stopped. So completely remove the exposure. The drug was started generally within days to weeks, a week prior to that. The magic number is 8 days. And when you re-challenge somebody, it can happen much quicker. It can be difficult and take time to analyze this. And we generally exclude all drugs started around the onset or after the onset of the rash. And it can continue for a couple of weeks and in some cases longer than that. So here's the way we cheat. There's a guy by the name of Jerome Litt, and I know him personally. He's quite a colorful individual. He's a dermatologist. Years ago, the Academy of Dermatologists put together a database of cutaneous reactions to drugs. And there was a case where an attorney was able to subpoena that, provided a malpractice case against a dermatologist for data that was not known to anybody. And so the Academy of Dermatology stopped that, but Dr. Litt continued that, and he's accumulated this database. So there's an online database and there's a published database. So we cheat. We use this Bible for drug eruptions, and it helps us classify various drugs in the class that they have, and then it goes through each drug and classifies it on a percentage-wise of how often we see this kind of drug reaction. And that helps us a lot. So let's talk about some of those. The skin is the most common organ for drug eruptions or drug involvement. Antibiotics and anticonvulsants are probably the most common, 1 to 5% of the patients. 2% of these patients of all drug reactions can be serious. And toxic epidermal necrolysis and DRESS, which is drug reactions with the eosinophilic and systemic symptoms, and SCAR, which is serious drug cutaneous adverse reactions, can be even fatal if untreated or treated inappropriately. Most common drug adults, females and boys less than three are the most common patients with that. And not all drugs cause eruptions at the same rate. Aminopenicillins, 1.2 to 8% of exposures. Trimethoprim sulfate methoxazole, 2.8 to 3.7. NSAIDs, 1 to 200. Lamotrigine, up to 10% of those. So the anticonvulsants certainly are on the top of that. So the three basic rules is stop all unnecessary drug. Ask for non-prescription. We have patients that take lots and lots of non-prescription drugs, and with the advent of CBD and all kinds of other things, there's certainly a long list of potential drug interactions and complications and drug reactions from those. So always consider all medications, no matter how atypical. And so here's an example. The top two are from cephalosporins. The bottom one on the forehead is from phenobarbital. So you've got kind of a morbilliform eruption and a generalized systemic eruption, which is classic for drug eruptions. Here's a drug from ampicillin. Patients that have mono and ampicillin are going to be 85 to 95% chance of getting a reaction like this. And it's not necessarily, it's the ampicillin, which they may be able to take in the future, but it's the acute reaction with the Epstein-Barr and the mono. So this is fairly common. So here's patterns of drug eruptions. And so exanthematous eruption and those you can see in children's and adults in the time interval 4 to 14 days with 8 days being the classic aminopenicillin, sulfonamides, cephalosporins, anticonvulsants, allopurinol. Urticaria and anaphylaxis, and we can see that with significant problems in some of those patients, cephalosporins, penicillins, NSAIDs, monoclonal antibodies, and contrast media. Fixed drug reactions, a very interesting group of patients, and the percentage that are drug-induced are probably close to 100. The first exposure takes a couple of weeks. Re-exposure takes 48 hours, less than 48 hours, usually in 24 hours. And the tetracyclines, the pseudoephedrine, NSAIDs, trimethoprim sulfate methoxazole are common agents for fixed drug. We'll see some pictures of that. Acute generalized exanthematous pustules or AGEP, the beta-lactams, the microlides, the calcium channel blockers, and 70 to 90% of those are caused from that. Then drug reactions with eosinophilia and systemic symptoms, these can be quite serious with a mortality of up to 10%. The anticonvulsants, the sulfonamides, the allopurinol, minocycline, Lamictal, Stevens-Johnson syndrome, and toxic epidermal necrolysis. And up to 30% with TEN can have a mortality. So these are anticonvulsants, allopurinol, NSAIDs, sulfa drugs, and a good portion of those are from drugs. So let's look at some of those. And here's a vasculopathy. And you see a palpable purpura. So this is the smaller level of vessels. And these are palpable. And this is a vasculitis, and you can have a leukocytoclastic vasculitis, which goes into larger vessels, and you can get extravasation. You can also end up with ulceration at these areas. And drug-induced vasculitis or palpable purpura is independent areas, generally symmetrical. Urticaria-like lesion starts, and then you get ulcers, nodules, hemorrhagic blisters, pustules, and digital necrosis. Typically in the small vessel, and we look at vasculitis, we have small vessel disease and large vessel disease, and obviously large vessel disease is much more serious. 7 to 10 days after administration, 3 days following rechallenge, the penicillin, NSAIDs, the propylthiouracil, thiazide diuretics, Lasix, allopurinol, Dilantin, fluoroquinolones, and biologic agents as well. And so we stop the drugs, supportive treatment, NSAIDs and antihistamines, and here we look at the treatment being NSAIDs, and the culprit may be NSAIDs, so we have to be careful with that. This brings us to fixed drug reactions, and this tends to occur often on mucous membrane surfaces. The penile surface is common. It tends to reoccur at that same site. It has this violaceous appearance to it. It's fairly classic. A fixed drug reaction, and it occurs at the same site with each exposure of the medication, 1 to 2 weeks after the first exposure, and then with 24 hours of subsequent exposure. Clinically, they get these sharply demarcated erythematous and dusky violaceous color to it, which is really the key. It can occur anywhere, but it favors the lips, the hands, the face, and genitalia. 50% of these are on oral or genital mucosa, and 2% of the genital ulcers, especially in young boys, may be a fixed drug reaction. The treatment, removal of the drug, it tends to fade, leave a post-inflammatory brown hyperpigmentation, which will resolve with time. So some of the drugs that cause fixed drug reactions are the NSAIDs, the sulfonamides, the barbiturates, tetracycline, and phenethylamine. Are common areas, acetaminophen, cetirizine. There's a number of drugs there that you prescribe on a regular basis which are able to cause fixed drug reactions. Actinform eruption. And we see that with epidermal growth factor receptor, EGFR, in the treatment of lung and pancreatic, colon, rectal, and head and neck cancers, monoclonal antibodies, small molecule tyrosine kinase inhibitors, and these cutaneous reactions can be very significant. And here you can see this acneiform perioral dermatitis. Perioral dermatitis, also the most common cause of perioral dermatitis, is the topical use of steroids. So on the face, you don't want to use topical steroids that are potent. So we have 7 different classes of topical steroids. The face should only be in class 7, and occasionally in class 6. When you use stronger steroids, it causes this kind of reaction. A perioral dermatitis, certainly have to rule out other things. And oftentimes we make that as far as the medical profession in using topical steroids on an eruption like that, which makes it worse. Well, we talked a little bit about nutritional deficiencies. I'll show some pictures of that. Here's a lung cancer that's receiving radiation and is only on toast and tea diet and has myalgias and soft tissue bleeding, hemoglobin of 8, and he's deficient in what vitamin? In vitamin C. And you can see the corkscrew hairs there, as well as the gingival hyperplasia and bleeding. So let's talk about some nutritional deficiencies. And vitamin K deficiency, we see that in premature infants. We see that because they have uncolonized GI tract. We see it in patients that have malabsorption, liver disease, and we get clinically, we get purpura, we get massive hemorrhage, elevated PT and PTT. The treatment has obviously replaced the vitamin K. Vitamin B3 or pellagra, we mentioned that earlier. Dementia, diarrhea, dermatitis, and not treated appropriately, death. And so the diarrhea can be acute inflammation of the colon and small intestine. The dementia can be patchy demyelinization. We just talked about some of those conditions. And the type of dermatitis tends to be a photosensitivity. There tends to be perineal lesions and thickening and pigmentation around bony prominences and a seborrheic distribution on the face. And here's the Castle's Nicholas, which is part of that photosensitivity and is classic for the back, upper back, chest, neck, face. Pellagra, the depression, alopecia, acopathy, I'll get it. Psychosis, coma, death in 4 to 5 years if untreated. So treatment with niacin in 50 to 300 milligrams and IV if malnourished. Scurvy, we saw that picture, the water-soluble vitamins found in fresh food, and certainly the collagen and ground substance require that. We see that in synthesis of epinephrine and keratin and leukocyte function. And it acts as a cofactor for the hydroxylation of procollagen to collagen. So we see that in elderly male alcoholics, psychiatric disease with restrictive diets in young children. You get the four H's, hemorrhage, hemorrhagic gingivitis, epistaxis, perifollicular petechia, subungual, and IM interarticular hemorrhage and subostial hemorrhage. You get hyperkeratosis of the hair follicles. You get the hypochondriasis. And you get the hematologic abnormalities. So here's the corkscrew hairs, and here's the woody edema in that area, depression, anemia, and certainly ascorbic acid is the treatment of that. Zinc deficiency, and we use a lot of zinc because it improves wound healing. We see lots of ulcers, and we put everybody on zinc-containing vitamins, and it is partially responsible for immune and reproductive and neuropsychiatric function. And so it helps in infections post-surgically and cancer and pregnancy. Large amounts, dependent upon food intake, can make a difference with that. In premature infancy, there's suboptimal absorption, and we see a specific type of zinc deficiency in some of these patients. And it occurs the time of weaning, sometimes from breast milk to cow's milk, because of the change in zinc. Acrodermatitis intrapathica is a zinc transport irregularity, and so we see this in infants, and then we see it in acquired and alcoholics and malnutrition, chronic renal failure, malignancies, pregnancy, and HIV. So the D's here are the triad of dermatitis, diarrhea, and alopecia. The acral and periorificial distribution, you get this patchy, red, scaly skin. It often looks eczematous. You get an angular chelitis and stomatitis with drooling. The diarrhea can suspect an infant with chronic diaper rash and diarrhea, and it can be a generalized condition with alopecia, and there can be growth retardation, CNS findings, as well as emotional lability and irritability, and then poor wound healing with the zinc deficiency. So we see that with low serum zinc levels, not completely diagnostic. Alkaline phos can be low, and certainly the addition of zinc sulfate. And acrodermatitis intrapathica, those patients have a carrier protein malfunction, so we put those on long-term zinc supplementation. Typically wound healing, just to provide the best in care for those. Iron deficiency anemia, seen with a decrease in total body iron content, seen in menstruating women, patients that are low in red meat and diminished absorbable dietary iron. You get iron balance achieved with absorption in the proximal small intestine, and we check serum iron, total iron binding capacity, and ferritin, and then the addition of iron sulfate. Plummer-Vincent syndrome is seen in middle-aged women with microcytic anemia and dysphagia and esophageal webs, as well as the thin lips with increasing elastic opening around the mouth, somewhat sclerodermitis. Here's the colonychia, or spoon nails, that we see in patients with iron deficiency anemia. 40 to 50% of these patients have that. Can be physiologic in kids. You can also get glossitis, the angular chelitis, pruritus, and telogen effluvium, which is the temporary loss of hair, and lots of hair comes out at the same time. That brings us to red skin. I'm red and scaly from head to toe. And so that's what we call a generalized erythroderma. And so when we see a patient with generalized erythroderma, we have to go through a number of diagnostic thoughts to look at that. And here's kind of a pie chart that shows the things that typically present with generalized erythroderma. And eczema is the most common, followed by psoriasis, but then you have other things like Sézary syndrome, drug eruption, and then others. And those include bacterial, fungal, viral infections, and autoimmune disease. So these patients can be quite ill, and patients that have a generalized erythema with psoriasis, and we treat these aggressively and systemically. A very common condition, seborrheic dermatitis or dandruff, can occur on the body as well. And we can see a significant amount. And here is a patient with sebderm on the chest, which is probably secondary to the overgrowth of Malassezia furfur, which is a yeast form that occurs on there. Drug eruptions, of course, can cause that. And Then pityriasis rubra pilaris is a condition where there's a defect in vitamin A absorption, and you get this nutmeg grater, and you get this islands of sparing. You get serious hyperkeratosis of palms and soles. These patients can be quite miserable, and PRP. So lymphoma can cause that as well. So when you see a generalized erythroderma, you've got to think about that. Now we're going to kind of switch gears a little bit and sort of in the same realm. This is a 65-year-old, presents with tender skin all over, and it began a few days after cough and fever and chills. And here the patient has this generalized erythroderma, but it's a little bit different. There also is photophobia now, dysphagia, odontia, and a recent history of an antibiotic for a large boil that developed on her leg. She also has a past medical history of a seizure disorder. So the Lamictal and Bactrim are the two drugs that she's on. Both are capable of causing this kind of reaction. And this is what we call a Stevens-Johnson toxic epidermal necrolysis syndrome. And the difference is subtle, but they're both similar in the process that occurs. Here you can see this characteristic dusky red erythema that occurs with some desquamation and some peeling. And so the spectrum of disease actually may go from erythema multiforme to Stevens-Johnson and then to TEN. And these can be very serious when they get to toxic epidermal necrolysis. So the Stevens-Johnson is when there's less than 10% of body surface area. Stevens-Johnson's to TEN overlap is 10 to 30. And if it's over 30% of body surface area, then it probably is full-blown toxic epidermal necrolysis. And toxic epidermal necrolysis and staphylococcal scalded skin syndrome are reasons that a dermatologist will get up in the middle of the night and come in, because we can do a biopsy and do a frozen section and determine that difference. And the difference is significant. This patient had an infection or a presumed infection and started on the antibiotic. And of course, the thing that needs to happen is that we stop the antibiotic. And here you can see just a diagram of the difference of that with body surface area and mucous membrane involvement, with SJS more commonly involving the mucous membranes. And here's some of the common drugs that cause Stevens-Johnson's and TEN. And you can see those are drugs that we frequently use. Here is an infection, and this is in a younger patient, and this is mycoplasma is certainly the most common cause of Stevens-Johnson's in kids, and these can be quite nasty. You often have a flu-like symptoms preceding this eruption in the Stevens-Johnson and TEN involve two or more mucosal surfaces. Oral mucosa conjunctival surfaces are the most common, but other mucous membranes can be involved. And stop the drug promptly, and that certainly makes a significant decrease in mortality with these. These patients can have significant problems. Oftentimes, these patients with full-blown TEN need to go to the burn unit and have extensive care in that kind of environment. And they need supportive steroids. IVIG are somewhat controversial, and they may be helpful. And certainly, there's not a universal recommendation for that. Outcomes, epidermal regrowth takes three to 4 weeks, and ocular scarring and visual loss can occur, nail abnormalities, and mortality with SJS, Stevens-Johnson syndrome, 5%, TEN up to 30%. Here's a patient that had 50% involvement and got IVIG, and you can see him with significant scarring afterwards, but certainly a very rough course for this patient. And this brings us to the targetoid lesions, which we may see initially, and we certainly see that in erythema multiforme. Erythema multiforme can be a constitution of and related to SJS and Stevens-Johnson and TEN. So you get these targetoid lesions, and these are immune complexes that get deposited in the peripheral arterioles in the skin, and that's EM. And the most common cause of erythema multiforme is... anybody? Very common? Herpes simplex, of course. Herpes simplex is the most common cause of erythema multiforme, and that's the immune complex that gets deposited in the periphery. And generally, that's a self-limiting infection, as we know. And it's not generally the first time, because you have antibodies against that, and it's the immune complex that gets deposited there. So let's talk about a few infections with staphylococcal disease. You can see a long laundry list of those. There's a paronychia. You can get pustules, furuncles, erosions, honey-colored crust, typically of impetigo, bullae, erythema, desquamation, and vegetating pyodermis. Staph is the most common bacterial infections in children. It's extremely contagious with person-to-person contact, and you get Osler nodes, which are the ouch lesions, painful erythematous nodules with a pale center on the fingertips and thenar eminence and hypothenar eminence. Janeway lesions are non-tender, angular, hemorrhagic lesions on the palms. And there's the Osler nodes, and certainly those would make you concerned about what might be going on underlying that. Janeway lesions here. Community-acquired MRSA. Certainly we all deal with MRSA, and now we have vancomycin-resistant staph, and it appeared in 1961, and now I think it's about 70% of the general staph in the community-acquired staphylococcal infections, typically seen in patients a little bit older, exposure to MRSA. You get prior antibiotic therapy, which helps develop the resistance. And if we see suspected MRSA, we typically IND that, we culture it. Sometimes if it's just localized disease, that's all we need to do. If it's not, then medications like trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole, doxycycline, minocycline, or clindamycin. There's some newer drugs out now that seem to be very helpful in patients with MRSA. MRSA clearly is a problem in our practice every day, and we continue to see that kind of increasing. Impetigo, is the honey-colored crust. Often we have a carrier state in the nares, and so that spreads from there, and you get this honey-colored crust, and it can spread quite rapidly. If it's very localized disease, we can treat it topically with mupirocin. If it's systemic or widespread, then we often need to use an oral antibiotic along with that. Strep can also be caused by that. Staph and strep both can cause this, and the strep can cause acute glomerulonephritis. The most common cause of acute glomerulonephritis worldwide is what? It's strep, but what causes the strep infection? And that's scabies. And so scabies causes itching, patients scratch it, they get a strep infection, and off goes the race to that. And certainly certain serotypes of strep are more commonly 49, 55, 57, 60, and M2 strains are most commonly associated. Usually a good prognosis, but certainly can be a problem. Toxic shock syndrome, a thing that we used to see a lot more than we do now. It was suggested that that might be something that you might want to bone up on a little bit before a board exam coming up. It's an acute febrile multi-system disease. Staph aureus, often caused historically from the use of occlusive tampons in the 80s. When I was a resident, we saw a lot of that. I trained in the Navy. And you got cervical mucosal historically. We see it wounds, catheters, nasal packing. With those, the mortality is a little bit higher. It tends to be very low with the tampons. And that can lead on to necrotizing fasciitis, which can be quite bad. The problem is it's an exotoxin that's isolated in 90% of these patients. And there is in type 1 and 3. You get this acute febrile reaction with multiple systems involved, myalgias, rapid progression to shock, a diffuse scarlatiniform erythema, and it starts on the trunk and spreads centrifugally. You get erythema on the palms, soles, and bruise lines in the nails after recovery. And that's just as it grows out, it shows that. And you get telogen effluvium. Telogen effluvium occurs with any kind of significant insult. So the diagnostic CDC criteria are diffuse macular erythematous erythrodermic rash, bulbar conjunctiva, hyperemia, and palmar erythema, temperatures above three or more organ systems involved, GI, renal, hepatic, heme, CNS, desquamation of palms and soles, and negative Rocky Mountain spotted fever, leptospirosis, and rubella titers, and negative blood cultures, hypotension. So TSS, here's the bulbar conjunctiva erythema, and initially isolated from cervical mucosas. It's rapidly progressive. Mortality of non-menstruating conditions can be up to 12%, 5%, as I mentioned, in those. So the comparison of staph and strep, both of which are capable of causing TSS. Folliculitis, something we see every day. It's a superficial infection, and it can be due to staph, strep, or eosinophils, or in some cases due to yeast involvement in that. And it occurs more commonly in AIDS patients, patients that are immune suppressed. And staph is the most common, and you can also see it from Pseudomonas, particularly in jacuzzis and swimming pools, and other gram-negative organisms can cause that. They tend to be a little more aggressive. The superficial pustules tend to be mostly staph and strep. That brings us to scarlet fever. Certainly, it's still around. Is it all right if I go just a few more minutes? Group A strep, beta hemolytic, causes an exotoxin. It causes this generalized sandpaper erythema. You get systemic symptoms of headache, malaise, chills, fever, anorexia, weight loss. Certainly checking ISO tibers and throat spobs. You get a strawberry tongue with enlarged exudative tonsils. The most common is 1 to 10 years. And here it is early on, you get this white tongue, and then later on it becomes more strawberry-like at the 4th to 5th day. And you get this rash with a circummolar pallor and scarlet fever. So it's still alive and well. Here's the comparison of the first day of the rash with flushed cheeks, pastia's lines, and as it gets better, you have increased density of the axilla, the strawberry tongue, the circummolar pallor, and this is scarlet fever. Erythema marginatum, something we don't see very often, but maybe a clue to underlying problems with the pericarditis in chorea and polyarthritis and rheumatoid fever, rheumatic fever. This erythema marginatum is very transient. It comes up with subcutaneous nodules. It spreads with patchy erythema peripherally, polycystic, and lasting only a few hours to a few days, and the lesions are generally asymptomatic. And that brings us to staphylococcal scalded skin syndrome. And the differential between TEN and staphylococcal scalded skin syndrome is quite important. The problem with staphylococcal scalded skin syndrome is it's a staph infection from a distant focus, and it produces a toxigenic strain of staph, which then causes this desquamation. And so the story may be similar to that of TEN in that the patient doesn't feel good. And in this case, instead of withdrawing the antibiotics, we need to be on high doses of antibiotics to control the staph and the toxin. And so you get this bright red blistering due to the toxin that's at a distant site. And so there's a desquamation similar to TEN, and we can do a frozen section of that and kind of differentiate those two. So in this case, of course, we need to use antibiotics. In the other case, we need to withdraw antibiotics. So there's a prodrome of malaise and fever and sometimes a purulent rhinorrhea or conjunctivitis. It usually the erythema starts on the head and then becomes generalized. And it generally spares the palms, soles, and mucous membranes, which is kind of opposite of that of TEN. You get perioral crusting and the desquamation continues to 3 to 5 days and re-epithelializes in 10 to 14 days. Mortality is low in this, 3% in children, but up to 50% in adults. And if adults have underlying disease, can be much higher than that. So the diagnosis is from intact bulli will be negative, so you have to do it from conjunctiva, nasopharynx, perineum, pyogenic foci of the skin, and of course the treatment is IV penicillin and supportive care. So here's the comparison between TEN and staphylococcal scalded skin syndrome. And this is kind of an important differentiation. So you have that chart. That brings us to another strep infection, and that's of erysipelas. And we see this frequently where you have this indurated area that becomes very hot, often constitutional symptoms with fever and tenderness. And this is often a lymphadenopathy and leukocytosis. And this area is woody, indurated. So when you palpate it, it's hot and it's very indurated. The face is the most common. The anterior lower legs are the second most common. You can get septicemia, deep cellulitis, and even a necrotizing fasciitis from this. You need to differentiate it from sebderm and from contact dermatitis and from lupus. But this comes up quickly, and we treat it orally with anti-streptococcal drugs, primarily PEN-VK. Cellulitis, we see cellulitis a lot, and it's a dermal infection with deep subcutaneous involvement. When I was in the Navy, we used to have to admit every patient with cellulitis because they could not go back to their ship or to their duty station with cellulitis, and it was always a battle between internal medicine and dermatology. We had a 39-bed ward when I was a derm resident, and it was full all the time. And so we got to take care of cellulitis, which could be treated easily as an outpatient. But because of the problems with the military, we got to inpatient treat those patients. And internal medicine and dermatology always competed to see who could get rid of the cellulitis. So it was certainly factors such as diabetes and alcoholism, lymphedema, previous venous disease, and lymphatic stasis. So it can occur almost any area and certainly has to be differentiated. It can go on to metastatic abscesses and septicemia and gangrene. Now, here's one of the reasons I wanted to get to this slide. Cellulitis doesn't occur bilaterally very often. It can, but these patients don't have cellulitis. They have significant venous insufficiency in the case of the patient on your right with the sort of bound down leg that looks like an upside down champagne bottle. That patient has lipodermatosclerosis, and that's not cellulitis. That's chronic problems with a past venous insufficiency, and this skin gets bound down. Now, you can also see erysipelas that you'll get this same kind of cutaneous defect on that. But generally, when you see it bilaterally, it's probably not infected. It's probably venous insufficiency. 70% of lower leg ulceration is from venous insufficiency, and we see sort of an epidemic of that. And so think about that. That brings us to Pseudomonas, and I'm about to get done here. Pseudomonas is one of those things that is around us. It does cause lots of mischief. It produces an exotoxin. It's distributed widely in the soil, the water, plant life, animal carriers, sewage, dust. It can occur in intertriginous, most areas, because it likes those kind of environments, the GI reservoir for infections in the intensive care unit, and it causes a wide spectrum of disease, paronychia, folliculitis, toe web infections, ecthymic gangrenosum, and burn super infections. And here's ecthymic gangrenosum, where you get infarct of that skin, you get bacteremia with skin conditions, and you get debilitated patients, generally leukemia, burns that end up with this. And healthy infants after antibiotic therapy in macerated diaper areas can do that. It starts with a vesicle and then becomes a hemorrhagic pustule and then a necrotic ulcer. And then you need to be concerned about Pseudomonas sepsis in here. So we treat that with aggressive antibiotic therapy. Here's nail involvement. We see this commonly. Pseudomonas colonizes underneath the nail and changes the color of that. When we look at pigmented lesions, we're always looking at nails. When you see this green, bluish coloration, it's due to the Pseudomonas change that occurs underneath there. And here's a gram-negative toe web with Pseudomonas, and certainly in somebody that's diabetic, that can be a limb-losing condition. Here you see a patient with external otitis, a malignant external otitis, which is Pseudomonas. And here you see hot tub folliculitis, and these are all due to exposure to Pseudomonas. And then that brings us to meningococcemia, And hopefully we don't see a lot of that, but you need to worry about that because it's still around. You get this exotoxin and you get inflammation. And I think I'm going to stop with one more slide here that anthrax is, a biologic agent, and the importance of anthrax is early detection. And those patients that had anthrax used as a biologic weapon, early detection of that saved their life. So you have some information on necrotizing fasciitis, and with that, I will stop.